combat. If I was too willing to defer to adults and assume they knew what they were doing, she was just the opposite, quite willing to think of them as fallible. But now, blindfolded, she had a vulnerability I'd never been aware of before. All her defenses seemed to reside in the high heat of her gaze. Twice, Genet almost walked into me as Invisible Man, veering off at the last second. The third time, she was millimeters away, and the Invisible Man snorted to suppress a laugh. Her hands, sweeping like windmills, found me and nearly took my eyes out. Then things turned strange. When I wore the blindfold, I found Genet in 30 seconds and Shiva in half that time. How? I followed my nose. I had no inkling such a thing was possible. I was seeing through olfaction. I heeded an instinct that only made itself known when my sight was gone. Shiva, when it was his turn, found us just as quickly. Suddenly, we forgot about the rain. When I blindfolded Genet again, it took her even longer than the first time. Her nose was no help. For half an hour, I watched her shuffle this way and that. Frustrated, she whipped off the blindfold and accused us of moving and of being in collusion. On both counts, we were innocent.
When Ghosh came home for lunch,
Genet and I rushed to tell him about our game.
"Wait, stop," he said. "I can't hear you when you speak over each other. Genet, you first. Begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end, then stop. Who said that?"
"You did," Genet said.
"The King and Alice in Wonderland," Shiva said. "Page 93, chapter 12, and you missed 4 words and 2 commas.
"I certainly did not," Ghost said, acting offended but unable to conceal his surprise.
"You missed 'the king said, comma, very gravely, comma.'"
"Right you are," Ghosh said. "Now, tell me what happened, Genet."
She did, and then begged him to referee. Ghosh stationed Genet here and there, and each time, blindfolded and sightless, I went straight to her. We blindfolded Ghosh at his request, but he was no better than Genet. We would have further explored the phenomenon, as Ghosh put it, but he had to return to the hospital. Genet's forehead stayed furrowed all afternoon, her eyebrows meeting in a V. I felt the venom of her gaze on my face.
"What are you looking at?" she said.
"Is it against the law to look?"
"Yes."
I stuck my tongue out. She flew out of her chair and came at me. I expected that. We tumbled to the floor. I soon pinned her flat on her back, her arms above her head, straddling her, but it was far from an easy task.
"Get off me."
"Why? So you can have another shot?"
"Get off," I said.
"I will, but if you start again, I will do this." I dug my knee under her armpit and into her ribs. Her anger dissolved into screams and hysterical laughter. She begged me to stop. Knowing her and how quickly the fire could flare when you thought you had put it out, I gave her another dose to make sure. When I stepped off, I did not turn my back on her. Genet could sprint faster than Shiva, but could not quite beat me over a short distance. Her gait was so effortless, her feet barely touching the ground, that she could run all day. I wouldn't race her over anything longer than 50 yards. Climbing trees, playing soccer, wrestling, or sword fighting, in all these, she was just about our equal. But Blind Man's buff had found a difference. During dinner with Hema and Ghosh, Genet was quiet. The yellow and silver barrettes had given way to a vicious claw clamp and a knitting needle going across. When Hema asked, she reported on her Secret 7 book. She sat next to me and Shiva, fending off Almaz and Rosina, who bustled around trying to add to our plates. The two of them always ate later in the kitchen. After dinner, Genet said her goodnights and retreated to Rosina's quarters behind our bungalow. I found Ghosh hunting through Alice in Wonderland. I looked over his shoulder as he found page 93. Shiva was right, down to the two commas. The rain stopped when we got into bed, precisely when it was too late to take advantage of the lull. The silence was both a relief and nerve-wracking, because at any moment it would start back up. Hema read to us in our bedroom, a nightly ritual that she had never interrupted once she began it in response to Shiva's silence. R.K. Narayan's Man-Eater of Malgudi was our text the last few days. Ghosh sat on the other side of our bed, head bowed, listening. The book had started slowly, and it had yet to pick up any pace. But perhaps that was the point. As we adjusted to the slow, the boring world of village India, it revealed itself to be interesting and even funny. Malgudi was populated by characters that resembled people we knew, imprisoned by habit, by profession, and by a most foolish and unreasonable belief that enslaved them, only they couldn't see it. The sound of the phone ringing was foreign to Malgudi, and it broke the thread of the story. Ghosh picked up the receiver. "Right away," he said, gazing at Hema. When he hung up, he said, "Princess Turinesh is in labor, 6 centimeters, pains 5 minutes apart. Matron is with her in the private room." "What does that mean, 6 centimeters? I asked. Ghosh was about to answer, but Hema, already at the dresser, brushing her hair, said quickly, "Nothing, sweetie. The princess will have a baby soon. I have to go." "I'll come with you," Ghosh said. He could assist if Hema opted for a cesarean section. I never liked it when they left at night. My dread wasn't intruders, but an anxiety about Hema and Ghosh, a fear that despite their best intentions, they might not come back. I never felt that way in the daytime. But at night, when they went dancing at Juventus or played bridge at Mrs. Reddy and Evangeline's house, I'd wait up for them, imagining the worst. After they left, I padded into the living room in bare feet and pajamas. I worked the shortwave band on the Grundig. Above the static, I heard the motorcycle. Halfway up our driveway, Sergeant Zamui would always cut the engine so as not to disturb us. Then, in silence, save for the squeak of springs and the rattle of mudguards, he'd coast into the carport. The coda was the metallic whoomp of cycle rolling back onto its center stand. I loved that ungainly BMW and the way its udder-like engine bulged out on either side of the frame. Shiva loved it too. All machines have genders, and that BMW was a royal she. For as long as I can recall, I'd been hearing her low throb, a lub-dub sound in the early morning and at bedtime, as Zamui left for and returned from work. Whenever I heard the tramp of his heavy boots receding, I felt sorry for him. I pictured his lonely hike home, particularly during this season of mud and rain. Despite the long raincoat and a plastic hood for his pith helmet, it was impossible not to get soaked. 5 minutes later, I heard the kitchen door open. Genet came in wearing my hand-me-down pajamas. Her anger from earlier wasn't there. In its place was something I rarely saw. Sadness. Her hair was held back by a blue headband. She was listless, withdrawn, as if years, not minutes, had passed since I last saw her. "Where is Shiva?" she asked, sitting across from me. "In our room. Why?" "Just asked. No reason." "Hema and Ghosh had to go to the hospital," I said. "I know. I heard them tell my mother." "Are you all right?" She shrugged. Her eyes looked through the glowing dial of the Grundig to some planet beyond. There was a little fleck in the right iris, a puff of smoke around it where a spark had penetrated. We were much younger, exploding capgun strips on the pavement, striking them with a heavy rock when that happened. You could only see the blemish close up and at certain angles. From a distance, the hint of asymmetry made her gaze seem dreamy. A crackly Chinese station faded in and out, a woman's voice with sounds no throat should be able to produce. I thought it was funny, but Gennett didn't smile.
Marion, will you play blind man's buff with me?
She asked in a sweet, gentle way.
Just one more time?
I groaned.
Please!
The urgency in her voice surprised me, as if her future depended on this.
Did you come back just for that reason? Shiva's already in bed.
She was silent, considering this, and then she said,
How about just you and me? Please, Marion?
I was never good at saying no to Gennett. I didn't think she would have any better luck finding me this time around than before. It would only make her more depressed. But if that was what she wanted. Outside, the rain had scrubbed the sky free of stars. The black night leaked through the shutters into the house and under my blindfold.
I've changed my mind, I said into the void.
She ignored me, tying a second knot to secure the blindfold. For good measure, she put an empty rice flour sack over my head, rolling up the edges to leave my mouth uncovered.
Did you hear me? I said. I don't want to do this. I never agreed to this. You cheated? You admit it?
The voice did not even sound like hers.
I won't admit what is not true, I said.
A gust of wind rattled the windows. It was the bungalow's way of clearing its throat, warning us to cinch up for more rain. She disappeared again, and when she returned, I felt my hands being strapped against my sides with a piece of leather, Gosh's belt.
That's so you won't remove the blindfold.
Now she grabbed me by my shoulders. She spun me around. Her hands were paddles, slapping my chest, my shoulders, turning me like a top. When I yelled for her to stop, she added a few more turns.
Count to 20 and don't peek.
I was still turning in that inner darkness, wondering why nausea had to be such a firm companion of vertigo. I crashed into something. A hard edge. The sofa. It caught me in the ribs. But it did keep me from falling. This wasn't fair, tying my hands, messing with my balance. She'd tricked me. If she wanted to disorient me, it had worked.
Cheater!
I yelled.
If you want to win so bad, just say you won, okay?
A sharp sound on the tin roof made me jump.
An acorn?
I waited, but it didn't rattle down the slope. A thief checking to see if anyone was home? With my hands bound, I was doubly helpless. I sneezed. I waited for the second sneeze. They always came in twos. But not tonight. I cursed the musty sack.
Screw your courage to the sticking place, I shouted.
I had no idea what that meant, but Ghosh said it a lot. It sounded vulgar and defiant, a good thing to repeat when you needed courage. My heart hammered in my chest. I needed courage. The scent I had to follow wasn't as distinct as it had been in the morning. Not being able to reach in front of me and being saddled with a sack on my head were huge handicaps.
I'll find you, I yelled, but then never again.
In the dining room, using my foot, I traced the sideboard, saying, Screw your courage to the sticking place, as my mantra. From there, I went on down the corridor leading to the bedrooms. I knew the spots where the narrow floorboard squeaked. There were many nights I'd stood outside Ghosh and Hema's room, listening. Particularly when they seemed to be arguing. With them, what you thought was a squabble could be just the opposite. I once heard Hema speak of me as his father's son, stubborn to a fault, and then she laughed. I was shocked. I didn't think of myself as stubborn, and I had no idea that I might be anything like the man I sometimes fantasized might come through the front gate. Hema never mentioned his name, and her tone of voice when she compared me to him suggested faint praise. Another night, I overheard Hema say, "Where? Exactly where? Under what circumstance? Don't you think we could have looked at sister's face, or his face, and known? How did we not know? They should have told us. Say something, Ghosh." I didn't get it. Ghosh was strangely silent. Now, with the blindfold on, I could recall every word of theirs. Covering my eyes had opened up new channels in my memory, just as it had fired up my sense of smell. I felt I needed to ask Hema and Ghosh about this conversation. What were they talking about? But how could I? I couldn't tell them I'd been eavesdropping. My nose led me to our bedroom. I turned in. I inched forward. I came to where the scent peaked. I was up against the dresser. Bending forward, my face touched flannel. Her pajamas. She piled them on top of my dresser. Like a tracker dog, I buried my nose in the cloth, shook my face in flannel, and scattered the pajamas, sharpening my instrument. "Very clever," I said. I knew Shiva was on his bed. He must have strapped on his big dancing anklet, because it sounded now, a noise that was his equivalent of a non-committal grunt. I retraced my steps. The kitchen was supposed to be off-limits, but that is where the trail led. But here, the scents of ginger, onions, cardamom, and cloves were like curtains that I had to claw through. On an impulse, I knelt and put my nose to the tiles. What chance did bipedal man have, nose high in the air, against a four-legged tracker whose nose was to the ground? Yes, there she was. The trail veered to the right. Inching to the pantry, I knew that this game, born out of monsoon tedium, was no longer that. No rules now. Nothing would be the same after this. I knew. I may have been just 11, but my consciousness felt as ripe as it would ever be. My body might grow and age, and I would soon have more knowledge and experience. But all that was me, all that was Marian, the part that saw and registered the world and chronicled it in an inner ledger for posterity, was well seated inside my body, and never more so than at that moment, robbed of eyes and hands. I stood up as I entered the pantry. "I know you're there," I said. The echo gave me a fix on that long, narrow room. I knew just where she was, and I went to her. Genet was in front of me. If my hands were free, I would have reached for her, tickled or pinched her. I heard a muffled sound. It could have been laughter, but I didn't think so. She was crying. I wanted to console her. The urge to do so grew. It was a feral instinct, much like the one that led me to her. I drew forward. She pushed me away, but half-heartedly. The push was a plea for me not to leave. I'd always assumed that Genet was content with her life. She ate at our table, went to school with us, and was part of the family.
She didn't have a father, and we didn't have our real parents,
and I assumed that, just like us, she felt lucky to have Hema and Ghosh. I saw us as equals, but in doing so, perhaps I glossed over the things she could not overlook. Our bedroom was bigger than her narrow and drafty one-room quarters. At night, if she wanted to visit the privy, Genet had to step out into the elements, passing the open shed where we stacked firewood. While Ghosh and Hema tucked us into bed, transported us to the magical world of Malgudi, then turned off the lights, Genet read to herself under the single naked bulb, trying to tune out the radio which Rosina played late into the night. There was one bed, and mother and daughter slept in it, but Gennet would probably have relished her own bed. A charcoal brazier provided warmth. The smoke and incense that permeated her clothes embarrassed her. If we found her quarters cozy, she was ashamed of where she lived. In earlier years, we were as often in that room as we were in our house. But of late, though Rosina welcomed us, Gennet didn't encourage us to come in. Blindfolded, I suddenly saw all this so clearly. I understood her fierce competitiveness in a way I'd never appreciated. One more step forward. I waited. The push or punch did not come. I inclined my head, used it as a probe to find her. Her ear and then her cheek brushed against mine. Wet. Her jerky breathing was hot against my neck. Slowly, she settled her chin there. The feral self stood dutiful and protective. Watch and learn, it said to me. Defend and comfort. I felt heroic. My feet were close together. I had tilted forward to counter her weight. When she readjusted, I fell against her, sandwiching her against the pantry shelf. Our bodies were touching at the thighs, hips, and at the chest, our cheeks still together. I waited for her to push me back to the vertical, but she didn't. How well we knew each other's bodies from wrestling, from pulling each other up to the treehouse, and from earlier years wading in our splash pool together. In the big packing cases, stuffed with straw in which glassware was shipped to missing, we played house and doctor. We were never self-conscious about our anatomical differences. But now, blindfolded, her face invisible to me and mine obscured by cloth, it was all new and unknown. I wasn't the invisible man. I was the blind man who could see, who is forgiven his clumsiness by the other qualities the blindness brings out. Though my arms were pinned to my side, I could swivel my hands forward. I touched her hips. Her skin was cold. She didn't flinch. She needed my touch, my warmth. I pulled her to me. She trembled. She was naked. I don't know how many minutes I stood there. It was precisely the comfort she seemed to need this night. If only she had known to ask, or I to give, we could have done away with the blindfold. Thank God for the blindfold. She worked her hands into the gap between my arms and my trunk. She hugged me. It was an awkward, painful pose for me, yet I didn't dare say a word for fear she'd let go. The rain murmured gently on the tin roof. After an eternity, she withdrew her arms. She took the rice bag off my face. She undid my restraint, freeing my hands, and I heard the belt buckle clatter to the floor. But she left the blindfold on. If I'd wanted to, I could have taken it off. I missed her embrace. I wanted to feel it again, now that my arms were free. I reached for her. Naked, she felt smaller, more delicate. Something soft, fleshy, touched my lips. I had never been kissed before. At the movies, Gennet and I groaned and laughed when we saw the actors kiss. There was always one Italian movie in the triple feature, particularly at the Cinema Adua. It was either dubbed or had subtitles. It typically came before the short comic feature, The Chaplain or Laurel and Hardy, and it always had lots of kissing. Shiva studied those on-screen smooches with great seriousness, cocking his head. Gennet and I didn't. Kissing was silly. Adults had no idea how stupid they looked. Our lips were dry. A big nothing, just as I thought. Perhaps the kissing had the same purpose as the embrace, to give and get comfort. I tilted my head to one side, movie style, wondering if the sensation would get any better. I caught her lower lip between my lips. This was a new discovery, that the mouth could be this delicate, tactile instrument, particularly in the absence of sight. Her tongue touched my lips, and I wanted to snap my head back. I thought of the 25-cent, 1-hour sucker on which the three of us took turns. Now, slowly, our two mouths shared the candy without the candy. Not really pleasurable, not disgusting either. Gennett's hands were on my face. They did that in the movies. I slid my right hand to her shoulders, then down her chest. I felt the hillocks on which her nipples sat, no different than mine. Her fingers slid down to touch my chest, where it should have been ticklish, but it was not. My hand swept over her belly, and then down farther between her legs, running over a soft fissure. The absence, the empty space, more intriguing than what might have been present. Her hand, tentative like mine, slipped past my waistband, prospecting. When she held me, it felt so different than when I touched myself. The door from the outside to the kitchen opened. It had to be Rosina, or perhaps it was Ghosh and Hema. The footsteps went on into the living room. I stepped back. I pulled off the blindfold, blinking in the dark pantry, an alien landing on Earth. In the reflected light of the kitchen, Gennett's eyes were moist, her face puffy and her lips swollen. She didn't want to meet my gaze. She preferred me blind. Her eyes were slanted, her nose rising to a quick point. Her forehead planed back, not at all like Rosina's rounded one. She looked like the bust of Queen Nefertiti in my Dawn of History book. My blindfold was off, but I still possessed a hyperacuity of the senses. I could see the future. Gennett's face in that pantry was the face that most revealed her. It carried intimations of the woman she would grow up to be. I could see how those eyes would stay serene, beautiful, concealing the kind of restlessness and recklessness so evident tonight. Her cheekbones would push out, expressing the sheer force of her will, making her nose even sharper, further elongating her lovely eyes. The lower lip would outgrow the upper, the buds on her chest turn into fruit, and her legs would grow like tall vines. In a land of beautiful people, she would be most beautiful and exotic. Men, I knew this before I should have known, would perceive her disdain and would want her. I would want her most of all. She'd put up obstacles. I might never be as strong for her or as close to her as I was this night. Despite this knowledge, I'd keep trying. I knew all of this. I felt it, saw it. It entered my consciousness in a flash, but the proof was yet to come. Rosina called Gennett's name from somewhere in the house. I picked up the belt. How we could both be so serene, I'll never know. I touched Gennett on her shoulders, gently, carefully. The other moment of touch was long gone. Her eyes turned to me with what could be love or its opposite. "I will always find you," I whispered. "Maybe," she said, bringing her lips close to my ear. "But I might get better at hiding." Rosina walked in and stopped, frozen at the sight of us.
"What are you two doing?"
she said in Amharic. She smiled out of habit, but her brows conveyed her puzzlement.
"I've been looking all over for you. What are your clothes? What is this?"
"A game," I said, waving the blindfold and belt as if it answered her questions. But my throat was so dry, I don't think any noise came out. Gennett brushed past me, heading back to the living room. Rosina grabbed her hand.
"Where are your clothes, daughter?"
Let go my hand. But why are you naked?
Genet said nothing, her face defiant. Rosina jerked her by the arm.
Why did you take them off?
When Genet replied, her voice was cutting, spoiling for a fight.
Why do you take your clothes off for Zemui? When you send me out, is it not for you to get naked?
Rosina's mouth froze in the open position. When she could speak, she said,
He is your father. He is my husband.
Genet's face showed no surprise. She laughed, a cruel mocking sound as if she'd heard these words before. I cringed for my nanny as Genet spoke.
Your husband? My father?
You lie!
My father would stay the night. My father would have us live with him in a real house.
She was angry, tears spilling down her cheeks.
Your husband wouldn't have another wife and three children. Your husband wouldn't come home and send me out to play so he can play with you.
She pulled her arm free and went to get her clothes. Rosina had forgotten I was there. Innocence, the carefree days, hung over a chasm. She finally turned to me. We studied each other as if we were looking at strangers. I'd gone into the pantry sightless. Now the blindfold was off. Zemui was Genet's father. Was I the only one not to know this? How stupid was I? Why had I never thought to ask? Did Shiva know? All the long hours the colonel spent with us playing bridge. It made sense that Zemui was also around all that time. True, in matrilineal society, one accepted these things and didn't ask about a father when none was present. But I should have asked. I saw it now. The signs were there. I was blind and naive and dumb. All the letters I had written for Zemui to Darwin inquiring about his family and conveying best wishes from his pal had given no clue that Genet was his child. All those written words, spoken words, were just the shimmering surface of a deep and swift river. To think of the nights I had lay in bed, hearing that motorcycle, feeling sorry for Zemui trudging home in the rain, in the dark. Clearly, I wasn't the only one to feel compassion for him. Rosina knew me so well she could read the progression of my every thought. I hung my head. I'd slipped in the esteem of my beloved nanny. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw that now her head was down too, as if she'd failed me, as if she had never wanted me to know this side of her. I wanted to say, About what you saw, it was a game. I said nothing. Genet returned, clothed in the flannel pajamas. She left without a backward glance, and Rosina followed. Shiva was in the dining room, just beyond the door to the kitchen. I stayed in the pantry after shutting the door, and I stood facing the shelves. A scent lingered. An ozone generated by me and Genet, by our two wills. I heard footsteps draw near and stop, and I knew that Shiva was on the other side of the door, just as he knew I was on this side. Shiva Marion couldn't hide much from Shiva or Marion. But I squeezed my eyes shut and turned invisible and carried myself to a place where I was completely alone and no one could share my thoughts. Chapter 21 Knowing What You Will Hear. In the days that followed, when Rosina ran her fingers through my curls or insisted she iron my shirt before we went out, it was as if nothing had happened. But I saw these acts of hers differently. They were familiar, but also designed to have a hand on me at all times, and thereby put her body between me and her daughter. Something had transpired that night in the pantry, just as Rosina feared.
I'd leaned on a hidden panel, and much like in the comics, I'd plunged through. The falling was unintentional, but now that I was on the other side, I wanted to stay. I wanted to be around Gennett more than ever, and Rosina knew it. I saw a new dimension to Rosina. Call it cunning. The same cunning was in me as well, because I no longer felt safe telling her what I was thinking. But my feelings were tough to hide. When I was with Gennett, I felt the blood rushing to my face. I had forgotten how to be. For the rest of the holidays, Gennett gravitated to Shiva. His presence generated no awkwardness, while mine clearly did. I watched them put on their practice record, clear the dining room, strap on their anklets, and run through their complex routines in Bharatanatyam. I wasn't jealous. Shiva was my proxy, just as I had been his when Almaz had given me her breast. If I could not be with Gennett, wasn't Shiva's being with her the next best thing? Perhaps my bloodhound instinct, my ability to find Gennett by scent, was no more than a party trick. But perhaps not. We never played blind man's buff again. The very idea was disquieting. I avoided Zamui when he came to pick up or drop off his motorcycle, or when Colonel Mebratu came to play bridge. The Colonel enjoyed driving his Peugeot, or his Jeep, or his staff Mercedes, and the last time Zamui spotted me, he'd been riding shotgun and he waved and grinned. When I finally did encounter Zamui, I wanted to be annoyed with him. He had something in common with Thomas Stone, though Zamui at least saw his daughter every day. But when Zamui shook my hand and excitedly pulled out a new Darwin letter, I found myself sitting down with him on the kitchen steps. I was tempted to say, "Why don't you ask your daughter to do this?" But I didn't, because I understood something I had missed before, that Gennett surely didn't make things easy for her father. I was reading and writing letters for Zamui because his daughter had refused. On a Friday evening, the Colonel breezed into Missing and into Ghosh's old quarters, bringing energy with him, as if not one man but a regiment in full colors had arrived, along with the marching band. Half an hour later, there were two tables going. The players, Hema, Ghosh, Adid, Babu, Evangeline, Mrs. Reddy, and a newcomer they brought, seemed to inhabit their bridge hands, becoming pass and three-note trumps, their faces flushed with concentration. Adid, the cart merchant and old friend of Hema's, owned a shop in the Makato right next to Babu's and had brought him into the group. A burst of conversation like a collective sigh signaled the end of a round. I loved to observe them play. The Colonel, just back from London, had a rare bottle of Glenfiddich for Ghosh, chocolates for us, and Chanel No. 5 perfume for Hema. The cigarettes in the ashtrays were Dunhill and 555. His contribution again. Though he wore a blazer and open shirt, his tucked-in chin and the shoulders drawn back made it seem he was still in uniform. If he left the party, I imagine the rest of them would slump over like toys whose spring had unwound. Evangeline, an Anglo-Indian, a bridge regular, turned to Colonel Mebratu.
"A little bird told me that we might soon be calling you Brigadier General. Is that true?"
Colonel Mebratu frowned. "Such vicious rumors, such an incestuous community. And I fear, Evangeline, you are at the center of it. But in this case, I must correct you, my dear. I am not soon to be called Brigadier General. As of yesterday, I am Brigadier General." Well, there was no stopping them after that. Zamui and Gibru made two runs for food from the Ras Hotel. Much later that night, Mebratu and Ghosh palavered over cognac and cigars.
In Korea, in 52, we were one of 15 countries in the UN forces. I wasn't long out of command training when I went there. The other countries underestimated us. You see, they knew nothing about Ethiopian courage or the Battle of Adwa or any of that. By God, we proved ourselves in Korea. By the time we got to the Congo, they knew what to expect. We had an Irish commander, then a Swedish commander, and in the third year, they made our own General Guebre commander of all the UN forces. You know, Ghosh, as a career military man, that was my proudest moment. Even more than this promotion I got yesterday. I'll never know how, but Ghosh understood what I was going through after the pantry episode. Perhaps he recognized that I was quarantined from Genet and that Shiva didn't share in that experience. Perhaps he saw my confusion when Zamui was around. Maybe it was written on my face that I'd become aware of human complexity. That's a kinder word than deceit. I was trying to decide where to peg my own truth, how much to reveal about myself. It helped to have such a steadfast father in Ghosh, never fickle, never prying, but knowing when I needed him. Had Hema learned what went on in the pantry, I'd hear about it 2 seconds later. But Ghosh, if he knew, was capable of keeping his peace, biding his time, hearing me out. He'd have even kept it secret from Hema if he didn't think it served any purpose to tell her. One wet afternoon, when Genet and Shiva were having their dance lesson with Hema, Ghosh telephoned and asked me to meet him in casualty. I want you to feel a most unusual pulse. Ghosh was primarily a surgeon now, operating electively 3 days a week and doing the emergency cases as needed. But, as he often said at dinner, he was still an internist at heart and couldn't resist coming down to casualty to see certain patients who presented a diagnostic puzzle, one that neither Adam nor Bocelli could crack. I was grateful for Ghosh's call. I never had any interest in dancing, but it bothered me to see Genet enjoying something in which I had no part. I put on my gutta percha boots and raincoat and dashed out with my umbrella. Demise was in his 20s, sitting on the examining stool in front of Ghosh, wearing only torn jodhpurs. I noticed at once the bobbing of his head, as if an eccentric flywheel turned within him. It was my first formal visit with a patient, and I was embarrassed. What would this barefoot farmhand think of a young boy entering the exam room? But he was thrilled to see me. Later, I realized that patients felt privileged to be singled out in this fashion. Not only had they made it past Adam, not only had they seen the Tilak doctor, the same big doctor whom the royalty came to see, but now they got a bonus. Me. Ghosh guided my fingers to Demise's pulse at the wrist. It was easy to feel, unavoidable, a surging, slapping, powerful wave under my fingertips. Now I could see that his head bobbing happened in time with the pulse. Now feel mine, Ghosh said, holding out his wrist. It was harder to find, subtle. He had me go back to Demise's pulse. Describe it, Ghosh said. Big, strong, like something alive under the skin, slapping, I said. Exactly. That is a classic collapsing or water hammer pulse. Its full name is the Corrigan's water hammer pulse. He handed me a foot-long thin glass tube that I'd seen lying across his table. Hold it up. Now turn it over. The tube was sealed at both ends and had a little water in it. When I flipped it, the water raced down to the bottom of the tube with an unexpected smacking sound and a shock. There's a vacuum inside, you see? He said. It's a toy that kids played with in Ireland. It's a water hammer. Dr. Corrigan was reminded of the toy when he first felt a pulse like Demise's.
Ghosh had made the water hammer for me. He had sealed one end of a glass tube with a Bunsen flame. Then he put a few drops of water inside the tube through the open end. He heated the length of the tube above the liquid to drive the air out and quickly seal the open end under the flame.
Demise's heart shoots blood out into the aorta. That's the big highway leading out of the heart, he said, making a sketch for me on paper. A valve right here at the exit from the heart is supposed to close after the heart contracts to keep the blood from falling back into the heart. His doesn't close well. So his heart squeezes blood out just fine, but half of that ejected blood falls right back into the heart between squeezes. That's what gives it the collapsing quality. How exciting to be able to touch a human being with one's fingertips and know all these things about them. I said as much to Ghosh, and from his expression, you would think I'd said something profound. He sent for me often during those holidays. Shiva came at times, but not if it interfered with his dance lesson or if he was in the middle of drawing. I learned to recognize the slow, heaving, plateau-like pulse of a narrowed aortic valve. It was the opposite of a collapsing pulse. The small valve opening made that pulse both weak and prolonged. Pulsus parvus et tardus, Ghosh called it. I love those Latin words for their dignity, their foreignness, and the way my tongue had to wrap around them. I felt that in learning the special language of a scholarly order, I was amassing a kind of force. This was the pure and noble side of the world, uncorrupted by secrets and trickery. How extraordinary that a word could serve as a shorthand for an elaborate tale of disease. When I tried to explain this to Ghosh, he was excited. Yes, a treasure trove of words. That's what you find in medicine. Take the food metaphors we use to describe disease. The nutmeg liver, the sago spleen, the anchovy sauce sputum or currant jelly stools. Why, if you consider just fruits alone, you have the strawberry tongue of scarlet fever, which the next day becomes the raspberry tongue. Or how about the strawberry angioma, the watermelon stomach, the apple core lesion of cancer, the peau d'orange appearance of breast cancer. And that's just fruits. Don't get me started on the non-vegetarian stuff. One day, I showed Ghosh the notebook in which I had kept a written catalogue of everything he had told me and every pulse I had seen. Like a birder, I listed the ones I sought. Pulsus paradoxus, pulsus alternans, pulsus bisferiens, and simple drawings of what they might look like. He wrote in the flyleaf, Nam et ipsa scientia potestas est. That means knowledge is power. Oh, I do believe that, Marian. We didn't stop at pulses. I went to Ghosh as often as I could. Fingernails, tongues, faces. Soon my notebook was chock full of drawings and new words. I found use at last for my penmanship. Each figure was carefully labeled. On a Friday evening, our last weekend before school started, I rode with Ghosh to see Farinacci, the toolmaker. Ghosh handed Farinacci two old stethoscopes and a drawing of his idea for a teaching stethoscope. Farinacci, a dour stooped Sicilian, wore a vest under his leather apron. He studied the drawing carefully through a haze of cigar smoke, tracing the outline with a large forefinger. He had fashioned several contraptions for Ghosh, including the Ghosh retractor and the Ghosh scalp clip. Farinacci shrugged, as if to say if that was what Ghosh wanted, he would do it. As we were driving back, Ghosh pulled out a present he'd wrapped for me. It was my very own brand new stethoscope. You don't have to wait for Farinacci. Now that you know your pulses, we're going to start listening to heart sounds. I was moved. It was the first gift I'd ever received that wasn't one of a pair. This was mine alone. Looking back,
I realized Ghosh saved me when he called me to feel Demise's pulse. My mother was dead, and my father a ghost. Increasingly, I felt disconnected from Shiva and Hema, and guilty for feeling that way. Ghosh, in giving me the stethoscope, was saying, "Marian, you can be you. It's okay." He invited me to a world that wasn't secret, but it was well hidden. You needed a guide. You had to know what to look for, but also how to look. You had to exert yourself to see this world. But if you did, if you had that kind of curiosity, if you had an innate interest in the welfare of your fellow human beings, and if you went through that door, a strange thing happened. You left your petty troubles on the threshold. It could be addictive.
Chapter 22. The School of Suffering. One morning toward the end of Michaelmas term, as Shiva, Gennet, and I walked to Missing's Gate, school satchels in hand, I saw a couple racing up the hill toward us, a child flopping lifeless in the man's arms. They were ready to drop, yet still trying to run up that incline when they had no breath to walk. But as long as they ran with the child in their arms, it was still alive to them, and there was hope. Without a moment's hesitation, Shiva Marian raced to meet them. The parents' distress triggered this, gave us no time to debate our response as a higher brain emerged, doing the deciding for us and guiding us to move as one organism if we knew what was best. I remember thinking, in the midst of that panic, how much I missed that state and how exhilarating it was to be Shiva Marian. Even as I grabbed the infant boy from the father, whose gait by now had become a weary shuffle, and raced away, Shiva's steady hand on my low back was my afterburner, and he matched my stride perfectly, ready to take over when I tired. I was conscious of the baby's skin, the way it chilled my hand, sucking the heat out of it as I ran. I knew I'd never again take being warm-blooded for granted, having now felt the alternative. We handed the child over in casualty, and we waited outside, panting. When the parents got up, we held the doors open for them. Minutes later, we heard a scream, then loud protests, and ultimately the wailing that means the same in any language. It was all too familiar a sound. There was another missing sound that made my adrenaline flow. It was the shrieking, grating sound of Gebru dragging the big gate open as fast as it would go. It always signaled a dire emergency. A childhood at Missing imparted lessons about resilience, about fortitude, and about the fragility of life. I knew better than most children how little separated the world of health from that of disease, living flesh from the icy touch of the dead, the solid ground from treacherous bog. I'd learned things about suffering that weren't taught to me by Ghosh. First, that white was the uniform of suffering, and cotton its fabric. Whether it was thin, shama or netala, or heavy as a blanket, in which case it was a gabi, it must keep the head warm and the mouth covered. No sun or wind should hit because these elements carried the mitch, the bird, the other evil miasmas. Even the minister with the waistcoat and fob watch would, when he was ill, throw a netala over his coat, cram eucalyptus leaf up his nose, take an extra dose of koso for tapeworm, and then hurry over to be seen. Day after day, a white-robed mass flowed up our hill, gravity the current against which they swam. Those whose breath ran short, as well as the crippled and the lame, stopped at the halfway point to look up, to gaze past the tops of the flanking eucalyptus to where the African hawks soared against the blue sky. Once they crested the hill, patients went to the registration desk to get their card. From there, it was on to Adam, the man whom Ghosh called the world's greatest one-eyed clinician.
Short of breath, are you?
Adam might say to a patient.
But still you managed to run up the hill and get the fourth card of the day.
In Adam's book, a number under 10 on the outpatient card identified a hypochondriac more accurately than any test Ghosh might do. From my spot observing the daily influx, I once saw a proud Eritrean woman carrying a heavy basket. Inside was something large, sprouting with a surface that was red, raw, and weeping. It was her breast. It had become so huge from cancer that this was the only way for her and her breast to come to missing. I drew such sights in my notebook. My sketches were nothing like Shiva's, but they served me well. A glance at them allowed me to recall the memory, even if it was not Shiva's photographic kind. On page 34, I drew a child in profile, chubby-cheeked, healthy. But from the other side, his profile showed a chunk of his cheek, one nostril and the eye missing, so that his glistening teeth and pink gum and the recess of the orbit were visible. I learned from Ghosh to call this ghastly sight cancrum oris. It came about from a trivial gum or tooth infection which spread because of malnutrition and neglect, often during an episode of measles or chickenpox. Once ignited, it progressed rapidly, usually causing death before the child could be brought to missing. Sometimes the disease simply ran out of steam, or the body's defenses were finally able to contain the march, but at the expense of half the face. Death was perhaps a better fate than to live with a disfigurement. I watched Ghosh operate on this child. It was terrifying. And then I was in awe at what this man who sat down to dinner with us each night was capable of doing. Rotate a flap of skin to cover the cheek, and another the hole in the nose. Further flaps and reconstruction he planned for a later surgery. Even so, there was no restoring to normal the face, much less the soul of a child so scarred. After the surgery, what Ghosh said to me was, "Don't be too impressed. I am an accidental surgeon, son. I do all I can do. But your father, what he could have done to that face would have been as good as the best plastic surgeon alive. You see, your father was a real surgeon. I don't think I've seen anyone better." "What made someone a real surgeon?" I asked. Ghosh didn't hesitate. "Passion for his craft. And skill. Dexterity. His hands were always quiet. I mean, he had no wasted movements. No dramatic gestures. It looked slow, routine. But when you looked at the clock, you realized how fast it must have been. But even more important is the confidence once you make the first cut, the belief in yourself, which allows you to do more and get better results. I'm thankful I can do the simple things, the bread and butter operations. But I'm scared to death half the time." He was being modest. But it was true that Ghosh was a different being in the outpatient department where he saw consultations, the patients Bocelli and Adam kept for him to render an opinion. Ghosh's real skill emerged with those who looked normal to my gaze. Hidden from us unschooled observers, a disease had left its traces. A woman who wove baskets said, "On Saint Stefano's Day, I passed urine on a barbed wire fence." Or this from a sad, distraught coolie. "The morning after the Wednesday fast, I accidentally stepped over the cast-off water from a prostitute's morning wash." Ghosh listened, his eyes taking in the blister marks on the sternum, which said the native healer had been consulted. He noted the thick speech and guessed that the uvula had probably been recently amputated on a second visit to the same charlatan. But Ghosh had an ear for what lay beneath those surface words, and a pointed question uncovered a story which matched with one in his repertoire of tales. Then it was time to look for the flesh signs, the bookmarks of the disease, and to palpate and percuss
and listen with his stethoscope for clues left behind. He knew how that story ended. The patient only knew the beginning. There is one last sighting at Missing,